Hello and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent. I'm a senior editor at American Theater. I'm with
Susie Evans. I'm the managing editor.
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And we're here with a podcast about a couple topics. First, we're going to talk a little bit about some upcoming stories, that some of which should be up online soon, but are in our January issue about artist compensation, always a hot topic. We also have a dialogue among critics who've seen Joshua Harmon's play Bad Jews at various productions across the country. So that's a critics roundtable. We're very happy about that. And then we'll come back at the end and after that and endorse some things you should see, watch, think about, those kind of things. So let's start off with the artist compensation. You know, our January issue, it's a special issue on training, and we're focusing on training that
social justice oriented training to teach
theater artists to be social justice actors in the world,
advocates,
that kind of thing,
you know, documentary theater.
So that's the our planned special issue, but it just, I think, by coincidence,
we don't plan these things
because
we just
something's
kind of
in the
throw
air.
It
well, that's planned. That part is, that part's planned, but we happen to have two stories. Deep and I have both wrote stories which are about the topic of artist compensation. And Deep, you noticed a news item in the New York Times, and that inspired a large piece about.
Yes. Well, we got the release, and then I saw the article from Playwrights. It was about Playwrights Horizons, and they were covering health insurance. Well, half of the health insurance premiums for all the writers in their seasons, and they're also doing this very unusual thing, which is they're covering pre-production costs for playwrights as well. And that's an unusual trend in the field, because usually it's kind of acknowledged, or it's a given, that playwrights do not get paid in the same ways that actors and directors do, you know, by week or by day that they're in pre-production. Instead, they'll get paid later from the royalties in their plays.
Yeah, or by commissions up front. So it's all up front or back end, but they're not paid to be there on site. But of course, they will have to be there when their play is being written or staged and directed.
Or staged and everything like that. But during pre-production, like, actors and directors are paid like a set amount, because, you know, their unions demand
it.
But since playwrights don't have a union, then there's no one saying you need to pay these playwrights or we're going to sue you. So it's kind of like, you know, non-union actors. If you don't have to pay them, most people usually don't.
Well, that's interesting, because my article is about the ongoing battle we spoke about a little bit with Diane Rodriguez in Los Angeles, which is not just the resonance of the issue goes beyond Los Angeles, but specifically in LA, partly because there's such a huge number of actors there, but that's not the whole reason. You can get on stage there even as a union actor and get paid almost nothing, because there's an equity, used to be called an equity waiver, which basically meant the union had no say over productions in theaters under 100 seats. That's been revised over the years, and there's an increasingly robust theater scene there, small and large. And there's enough actors there that really want to get that would like to be compensated for their work, that there's a real movement afoot to try and revise that plan upward somewhat. It's not an actual contract, because no union is going to agree to an actual contract in which people are being paid, you know, gas money, or, you know, so far below minimum wage. It's an agreement among the members that says, yes, members, you can work under this if these certain conditions are met. So it's a fascinating debate. I do tend to think that there's enough really strong theater work happening on tiny stages for no compensation, and enough actors who get the creative satisfaction out of that, that they might still stay with a mostly less restrictionist code, but it'd be nice to see a little more compensation, you know?
And I guess this is my ignorance about union laws, because reading contracts is so much fun.
Yes.
But why does LA get like the special 99 seat? You don't have to pay your actors anything, and you can run for like 80 performances, which has given birth to like this, you know, theater scene of like tiny little theaters. But whereas in New York, there's like a shitload of theater, and everyone still gets, and they're all under 99 seats, but people still.
Well, there's showcase codes.
The showcase codes for
the showcase code in New York, you only get paid gas money or a Metro card. for, but you could only run 12 or up to 24 performances if you're in a seasonal theater like the Mint or something like that runs
a
season.
Yeah, right.
Although I think the Mint is actually off Broadway. But if you're an off Broadway company and you're on a showcase code, you really don't have the showcase codes. The name of them comes from the idea that the union can justify it by saying, this is a way for actors to show their work and get more remunerative employment somewhere else.
Of course, but in New York you only get 24 performances, in LA you get 80. Like, why is...
Well, it is a reflection of the market being a lot... There's a lot more actors there, a lot more actors who want to get on stage. And I think the pressures, economic pressures there are such that when the actors go to their... That, the union goes to their actors, the actors have consistently said... It's actually much more complicated than just the actors voting to say they want to do that, but that's basically what it is, actors voting with their time that they want to get on stage. The complicated thing is that a lot of these actors are basically producing their own stuff, so they're actor producers. And so their relationship to the union is really complicated. They can't sit in negotiation because they're both producers and actors. And, you know, a lot of them make the reasonable point, like, this is art. Why should there be, you know... so much regulation. I should, if I want to express myself and get up on stage, why should there be a union preventing me?
Sure, but then you get into the whole, I guess, it's the whole paradox of, if there are enough actors out there willing to work for free, then why do we have to pay anyone anything?
Right, of course. Yeah, well, you don't, that's the converse is, a union exists to protect work, paid work for professionals in its field, and it has to draw the line somewhere and shut out productions that are not. So,
but, and what Deep just said just reminded me of a line in Deep's piece about, like, if there are enough actors out there that are willing to work for free, like, why ever pay them? And then there's also, like, there's enough writers out there who are also willing to work for free, and often theaters are like, you should just be glad you're getting a production, playwright.
Yeah, yeah,
you should just be happy you're getting produced. Like, and so, and the same thing can even go for journalists. Like, you should be happy you're getting a byline.
Yeah, it's exposure. You're doing it for exposure.
You're doing it for exposure. And, like, I feel like everyone's getting a little bit tired of the exposure payment model.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's...
Well, journalism's going backwards, though.
Well, it's the exposure payment model is in all mediums, in playwriting and acting. And it's like exposure. How many times have you pitched something and been like, oh, well, you can do it for exposure? And young or inexperienced people of any medium will do that.
Right.
Actors, writers,
right.
Playwrights, anyone.
Exactly. Because then you assume that eventually you will be paid, but then what happens if enough people say yes and then at the end no one gets paid at any age? And so you have this problem of, and it's the same thing with actors and playwrights, of people being in the field for 10 years and scraping by on nothing on their work, and then 10 years later, they realize, oh, I want to have a family. I want to own real estate. I want to have health insurance. And so they just drop off. And so you see, like, this giant drop off of playwrights and actors. And so there's, like, no one fostering, like, mid-career playwrights or actors.
Well, I mean, I think what the young inexperienced person who accepts exposure payment as their method of payment doesn't realize what they're actually doing is devaluing the profession as a whole.
Yeah, there's an argument for that. I think there's an argument that you always need some way for those people to get in the door. And if you shut it off completely, you're basically taking, limiting opportunities for people. So you've got to have a low end. It's just, where do you set the floor for the low end?
Well, there's students, like internships and things like that, where students you justify with school credit and getting them interested in the profession. But I feel like once you're in the professional working field, to be doing something, I mean, I'm someone who took exposure payment when I was just starting out, so I don't want to knock it. But at the same time, there should be a barrier, and I think it's when you enter the workforce, where if you're doing work that you have studied and you plan on making your profession, you should be getting paid.
I think it's good to have some valves. You know, maybe that's the wrong analogy, but some entry points. There needs to be an entry point for new artists. I know there's a lot of debate about the Flea off Broadway and whether they're a volunteer company. I would say that it's acceptable in some ways for there to be one example of that in every town, but for that to be the system by which the entire theater scene operates, which is in LA. In LA, it's a predominant model. This sort of almost totally unpaid theater. I don't know how long that's sustainable. It doesn't sustain artists, and I think eventually it devalues the good work of the scene. that's going on. So anyway, the article is about that. What I thought was strong about your piece was you were pointing out how much you can try to make regulations, you can try to get unions to do this, but some of it is the theaters making it a priority, theaters and funders, and
right,
it really
right.
is not that much money.
Players Horizons give. They have seven writers.
$10 million budget.
They have $10.5 million budget, and they're giving these writers total. These seven writers total like $30,000.
Right.
It's like a couple thousand dollars extra for each writer, which you know.
Right.
That's like in New York City. That's nothing. That's rent for a month.
Right. Right. So I mean, it would be nice to see even more, but the priorities of these organizations and funders could change from, as you point out, institutions. Buildings, to the people who work in them, the artists. And, you know,
exactly.
This is an ongoing debate in American theater.
I don't know. There's always that complaint about, you know, you can pay your admin people a salary right. and health insurance, but you can't pay the people like working, like actually putting on the art and the ones that people actually see it, the audience sees every night.
Right.
And you can't give them a sustainable living wage. And so there's that paradox. And there's also, I mean, I think what was the big deal about when the Flea thing blew up was their fundraising for this new theater company,
$18 million
building, mm-hmm. and I mean, there no judgment here whatsoever on priorities, but the rationalization is it's easier to get funding for buildings than it is to get funding to pay artists, and it's like sometimes I wonder if that's kind of like an excuse of some kind. Or
where are all the architects working for free?
Well, I mean, look, I think the argument
is like, why do you need a big building?
Well, it's not just a big building. It's also all those administrators, not all of them, but administration and buildings are. It's good to have a nice place to work, especially if you're not getting paid. To have a nice place to work that someone answers the phone and that is kept clean. I mean, the people on stage are not the only people who create. Make theater happen.
But maybe it's also the funders are usually the patrons and the theater goers, and they like to have a nice theater in which to see their art that they're
funding.
Like,
I think
they
that's, want to that's, put, an, that's you can't ignore that part of the theater going experience. I mean,
and they want to put their name on a building.
It would be nice to see the balance shift, you know, and it is shifting in some ways. I think one reason your story was, I think, is timely is that there is a shift. The shift toward residencies and other ways to support artists and playwrights. And put the money where the art is, and try to develop artists who can have sustainable careers. It's always a worthy goal,
right? Even if theater is something that it's kind of a given that you can't have a sustainable career doing being a freelance artist. But
I don't think it's a given.
It's not a given. I think it's just you can't make it from just making art.
Right.
You have to teach.
Sam Hunter told me that like his generation of artists growing up. I mean, he's still fairly young. He's in his early 30s, and he was saying like they have accepted that they can't make a living being a playwright. But like, why is that the acceptable mindset?
I mean, there was some article in the Times years ago. Maybe it was an article, which is a side note in an article about how much money David Henry Hwang makes, and like something about how like he hardly makes his living as playwright.
Well, Tony Kushner doesn't make his living as a playwright
either.
Yeah,
no one does. Except
there are a few people. Chris Durang mostly makes his money from playwriting.
Matthew Lopez.
Richard Greenberg.
And he also teaches at Juilliard, Christopher Durang.
Right. So I think teaching is a one way, and TV. Teaching and TV are the two ways.
Yeah,
and
not royalties. No one makes money off of royalties. Unless you're Christopher Durang.
I wonder if Neil LaBute makes his money as a playwright.
Well, he's made a lot of movies.
I think it's mostly his movies.
He's got like four productions in New York right now, though, or this season.
Well, actually, when you think about it, he hasn't done a ton of movies, though.
He hasn't.
Not for a while.
And he has some TV series that's coming out soon, but...
All these folks are in the mix making money in...
And different.
In various media.
At least they're making their money as a writer.
That is true. That's true. Though Sam Hunter and Matthew Lopez, who I both interviewed, and Lauren Gunderson, actually, they all make their living solely as playwrights. And it's mainly, I mean, Lauren does it because, like, she had INU and it had, like, three productions nationwide and made her $30,000. And so maybe it's just, you just have to make theaters produce your work.
Right. But $30,000 is enough to live on for 1 year.
Of course.
Right. And I think someone like Young Jean, who's, as far as I know, only working in theater, she's living on commissions, grants, and, you know, royalties. I guess there's royalties, some royalties for her work.
3%. Yeah. If she's lucky.
But it is a limited career. Yeah, you can't only live. You can only be an emerging artist and get grants for that for so long. You can only live on commissions for so long. Most playwrights piece together livings in other ways.
Well, I thought it was interesting. I was reading that piece in the Times on Suzanne Laurie Parks, and she makes six figures as the resident writer at the Public, which was kind of amazing to me.
Well, how long has she had that job?
I don't know, but. Since the amount of money they quoted in that article, she'll probably live on that for a few years.
I think it was like 2008. It must like late 2000s. Yeah, before prior to 2000.
According to that piece, she makes $115,000.
She has a nice office too. I've been in there.
I mean, I think that's a pretty good model. I know Tim Sanford in the piece says, you know, that's just a handful of people, but you know, the idea behind that Carnegie Mellon residency thing.
Mellon Foundation?
The Mellon Foundation. Oh, not Carnegie Mellon. Mellon Residence. Mellon Foundation. I get them mixed up. Mellon Foundation Residence Fund is, you know, that if there are 40 or 50 playwrights making a living that weren't there before, that's a big amount.
Well, then there's a difference between making a living and then making
a lot
of money. Like, look at what's that award that Steven Adler just won? The Mimi Award.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you look at something like the MacArthur Genius Grant. It's huge, like.
Oh, yeah. Young Jean was a MacArthur Genius grantee,
yeah.
too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
she was?
Yeah, she was. So she's probably still living
on... So is Sam Hunter now.
Yeah, so Sam Hunter.
So Terrell, Alvin McCraney.
Was he?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Like a year ago. 2 years ago.
But it's kind of like winning the lottery. Well, it's kind of... Well, it's... I mean, I guess that's the same for acting as well.
I think the odds are a little bit higher than the lottery, but
it's like 50 out of like dozens upon dozens of playwright graduates that come out each year from universities.
The percentages aren't good.
Yeah.
But they always give at least one or two to a playwright. I mean, Annie Baker's due for hers.
This is something I want to explore or maybe you explore, Rob, because you've already done it. Actors' compensation generally.
Oh, it's a fun topic.
Because I feel like it's a lot.
The big story now is the Equity Tour push. The Equity is really trying to crack down on non-equity tours, which is really kind of a crazy... It's taken off to a crazy extent. And it's amazing to me how little people have been upset about it. And it's good to see some pushback.
I feel like people have been upset about it for a while. I mean, I had a friend who did a non-equity tour 1 year, and then the next year, the same tour that she did was coming back. And they did split it into two. One's equity, one's non-equity, exact same production, exact everything. Same tour, same show, running at the same time in different cities. And the equity was getting – they were just getting paid a lot more. Everything else was the same.
Right. It's more that you hear consistent grumbles and eyebrows raised, but you don't hear actual – it just seems like it's business as usual increasingly. And that's the direction the business is going. And, you know – I think it would be great to have it swing back a little bit.
Well, the interesting thing about that whole conundrum and what Pat Healy addressed in his piece in the Times was the idea that you're charging theatergoers the same amount of money, whether there's equity actors or non-equity, or whether the production values or whatever.
And theater tickets are only getting more expensive, too.
But if you have the same, like he did focus on the Annie tour, if you have the Annie equity tour and the Annie non-equity tour, one of those has equity actors and higher production values. And one of those doesn't. You're charging the theater goer the same because they don't know. They're not educated about it.
Right, and they can't tell the difference if someone's equity or non-equity.
I mean,
for the most part. But no, I think I read something like a couple, like a year or so back, about how actors in equity tours now get paid less than they used to.
Well, they've made concessions, I think, because of this. And that's how the economic reality will work. And then why it's troubling, if there's a lot of non-equity tours, then equity's contract is going to, you know, be under pressure, economic pressure. If they want to have more equity tours, the producers might say, well, that's fine. Let's make a deal. So if they change the economic facts on the ground too much, then equity is screwed.
Well, my question is, how do you make a living? How do you make a living as an actor? Because no one gives grants to actors.
Very few.
There's very few teaching opportunities for actors.
PCG gives some grants to actors, but yeah, it's...
You can live on tour. If you're on tour as an actor, they're housing you, feeding you, and paying you a little bit.
Yeah, and there's...
Cruise ship?
On the West Coast,
Oh, God.
The West Coast, you can work up and down the coast. You can, in the I-5 regional corridor, You can also, if you're, I know a lot of folks who get out of drama school come to New York and then get cast exclusively out of town on road shows or summer stuff.
I mean, commercials
whatever.
Is a great way to make money. As
well,
an
then
actor.
You're talking about a whole other realm. But
they're still acting. They're still making money.
No, of course. Of course.
As an actor, they're still using their skill set.
Voiceover, commercials, a lot of...
Voiceover and commercials are good side jobs. I mean...
But, yeah.
You just get cast on Broadway deep and you...
Yeah, that's
how you do it.
Yeah, that's so simple. It's like everyone does it.
I do think that is the next... That is the groundswell. I've just... That the idea of trying to revive some sense of acting companies is something that theaters big and small are trying to figure out ways to do. But they're up against a lot of resistance and, you know, the cases we were just talking about, like in Los Angeles where the standard is not to get paid much at all. How are you going to create a resident company of actors who get paid a living wage when the standard is not even to be paid minimum wage? It's a tough one. But I just interviewed the folks at Everyman Theater. I don't know what they compensate, but they're in Baltimore, and their commitment has been to create a resident company there of Baltimore, D.C. actors. I don't think they're on staff, but they basically cast among the same pool, which I think is, that's the sort of thing that Mike Daisy was railing about, that American theater was failing America because they were just jobbing every actor from out of town and...
Right.
You know.
Well, in your piece, you brought up something that I want to actually follow, so you see what happens from it, where like these 20 theaters are talking about... Like,
just voluntarily paying actors more. Yeah,
exactly. Because all it takes is that, you know? All it takes is like a couple theaters saying, we're going to do this. And if it's like a big enough house that does it, then like more theaters follow because they see it like it's something that's feasible.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the thing I didn't mention there is that one thing about having, this is the case of The Flea, where they're able to do casts of like 100 people. Like literally, I think The Mysteries had 100 actors in it.
It was a lot of non-union actors.
Places like Antia's Company, which does great classical work, or The Open Fist, which does great work with big, huge casts. You can do shows with huge casts. If you paid every performer $25 a night at a theater like that, that would, your budget would go up by several orders of magnitude. So it is a question of like, it's created an economy where you have a lot of artistic freedom. And that's what it is. It's artistic freedom, but it's people's lives and time. It's that's part of the freedom. And you know, if the argument is if they freely want to do that, no one's forcing them to be in the show and they can take another job.
But then we go back to the thing of there's always someone, there's always 100 other people lined up to take your spot. I talked to Tim Sanford and this part didn't make it my piece, but I asked him, like, how does he see other theaters kind of...
If they're going to follow the lead?
Yeah, following the lead. And he says, well, if you're the kind of theater that's struggling to put on a four-person production, then it's probably not feasible for you just because, like, you're trying... It's like you need to have your budget in line. You need to have that kind of leeway. You can't be scrambling for resources.
Right. But it's nice to see the organizations that are not scrambling for resources are trying to spread them around more equitably.
Yeah, exactly. So it's mostly like, you know, larger houses just need to do it. Then the problem maybe will kind of take care of itself.
Right, right. Well, speaking of a playwright who's doing well, at least this year, Joshua Harmon... who wrote Bad Jews.
Oh, Susie loves the hell out of Bad Jews.
My favorite play ever. I love Bad Jews.
I liked
Maybe
it a lot.
Maybe not ever, but I'm pretty obsessed.
I liked it. I liked it a lot. Had a great time. As I confessed to our panel of critics, I felt as a non-Jew guilty about liking it so much. I felt like, should I be laughing at this? This is pretty close to the edge. But in any case, I sat and talked with Peter Marks, the critic for The Washington Post, Karen D'Souza, the critic for the San Jose Mercury News, and Wendy Rosenfield, the critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, about the productions of Bad Jews they saw in their respective cities. And here's our dialogue. We'll be back after that to endorse. Enjoy. Mazel tov.
Well, thank you all for doing this. We've done this once before. The idea is, you know, people talk about theater isn't part of the national conversation anymore, but some of these plays are, for better or worse, going all across the country. We did one a couple months ago, for Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, the most produced play in the coming season. Bad Jews by Joshua Harmon is the third most produced play in the coming season. So I just wanted to go around and talk to you all who have seen it. Let's go in order, I guess, of who saw it first. I think, Karen, you saw it first. Introduce yourself, tell us who you write for, and where you saw the play.
Hi, this is Karen D'Souza. I'm a theater critic with the Bay Area Newspaper Group and the San Jose Mercury News. And I saw the show a few months ago at the Magic Theater in San Francisco.
Great, great. And then I don't know which Wendy or Peter, which of you saw first. Let's go to you, Peter. You just saw it over the weekend.
Right? I just saw it over the weekend. I'm Peter Marks. I'm the theater critic at the Washington Post. And I saw Bad Jews at Studio Theater in Washington, D.C.
Great. And Wendy?
Wendy Rosenfield. I saw it a week ago at the Walnut Street Theater, Studio 3. And I write for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Broad Street Review.
Right. And you also did some extra credit reporting for us.
I did. I saw old Jews telling jokes, and I brought my own in-house old Jew. I brought my stepdad, who's 83, and he had a very nice time. It was completely the wrong show.
Oh, really?
But then we saw Bad Jews.
Did you also take him to see Bad Jews as well?
I didn't. I took my mom to see Bad Jews.
Okay. All right. So this play by Joshua Harmon premiered two falls ago in 2012 at the Roundabout Underground here in New York City. Then it moved upstairs to the Off-Broadway space, which is where I saw it. I had a great time with the show, but I want to let you critics talk about it. If one of you could just give us the premise, the setting, why don't we go with you, Karen, since you saw it first. Tell us, what's this play about, if someone asked for the thumbnail?
Kind of a comedy of bad manners. It's a family congregating after the death of a grandfather. Kind of familiar in that sense, except for what's interesting about this play is that it's all at the kiddie table. It's only grandchildren. There are no parents and no grandparents. And so it's sort of strictly a millennial, kind of a battle royale among millennials about their grandfather and what his legacy means.
Right, right. And let's go through the characters. They're such great characters, particularly Daphna Feigenbaum, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who's a fairly original creation. We published the play in our April issue, and I'll just take the liberty of reading. I don't know if you all read the script before you saw it or at any point.
No.
But nope. The hair on this character is one of the characters in the play, it's fair to say. and there's no mistaking why. The character description says she's 22. She's Liam and Jonah's first cousin. Those are her cousins. It says 2/3 body, 1/3 hair. Thick, intense, curly, frizzy, long brown hair. Hair that clogs the drain after one shower. Hair you find on pillows and in corners of the room and in your refrigerator 6 months after the head from which it grew last visited. Hair that could not be straightened even if you had 4 hours and 3 hairdressers double-fisting blow dryers. Hair that screams, Jew. So that gives you some idea of Joshua Harmon's voice as well, I think. And I guess a little bit more about the story before we talk about what we thought of it. In the story, the legacy of the grandfather is passed on. Why don't you, Peter, pick it up through you pronounce the word chai, is that right?
It's a chai.
Yeah.
Well, it's also, fair to say that this play is kind of the adult sleepover from hell. I mean, it's like, that's what we're getting here over the course of this event that takes place on one evening. And the crux of the dramatic story is the question of what's going to happen to Poppy's chai. The chai is the symbol. It's two Hebrew letters, which stand for, as I remember, life, and the number 18, which all have tremendous significance in Jewish culture. And Poppy wore this chai from the time that he was a young boy and an inmate at a Nazi concentration camp. We learn that Poppy hid the chai, which was given to him by his father, in his mouth, under his tongue, for 2 years. And subsequently, because he had no gold or jewelry of his own, other than that, presented it to his wife to be as their engagement ring, essentially, which she wore around the neck. And the question is, whether Daphna, who is the most religious of the cousins and is desperate to have this her own, as a kind of confirmation of her standing in the family and also an acknowledgement of her superior Jewishness, whether she's going to get this or whether Liam, the older of the brothers who own this apartment, or at least it was given to them by their parents, their wealthier parents. Daphne's from a poorer family, middle-class family. And the question is whether Liam is going to keep this keepsake, this heirloom for himself to present, we learn, to his Gentile girlfriend to whom he wants to propose.
Tell me about this, your take on this, on the title. It's a phrase that those outside the faith maybe don't know. We think of words like lapsed Catholic or Jack Mormon, but bad Jew, tell me what it means to you.
Well, a bad Jew, I'm probably a bad Jew. Right. To a lot of Jews. I was born into a Jewish family. I was bar mitzvahed.
Right.
I went to Hebrew school. I left Hebrew school right after my bar mitzvah, which is what bad Jews do.
Sure.
In the vernacular.
Right.
It means basically a Jew who's non-observant, mm-hmm. and there's a guilt attached to that too. There's a sense of, you know, you're not participating religiously at the level at which you owe it to the tradition and the culture and the survival of the religion to do.
You mean there's guilt attached to the word bad? No.
Well, it's yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, if you call yourself a bad Jew, there is a level of your own acknowledgement of that lack of fulfillment of your religious duties and passing on the traditions. But in this context, it's ironic, I think, the title. I don't think it's meant to imply, you know, we're watching a play about bad Jews. We're watching really a play about two Jews in particular who I think allow their poisoned hearts to infect their intellect and as a result behave badly.
Right. Yeah, right. That kind of bad. Wendy, I wonder if you want to chime in on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Peter pretty much said it. You know, bad Jew is someone who, you know, turns their back on the faith.
Right.
That's sort of the characterization. And you know, and it's bad. The title is Bad Jews. They're both bad Jews. The one who has sort of turned away from it and the one who has embraced it, you know, is as wholeheartedly as she has. And, you know, one could say that Jonah also, the other brother, you know, is included in that because he gets the tattoo and he kind of stays out of the discussions. So, I mean, I guess it could go either way in this context.
Yeah, I was interested in the way that it did seem to pivot, that clearly the point from Daphne's point of view, the others are bad Jews and she's the faithful one. But mm-hmm. I feel like the play complicates that because it turns out she's not all that she was cracked up to be. And the way she embraces the faith does seem to have a psychological component as well. So let's talk about what you all thought of it. You all saw different productions with different levels of hair, I imagine. I saw photos from all of them. It looked like they mastered the hair pretty well. So why don't we start? Karen, how did you like the show?
I thought it was really fast and funny and furious. I mean, I had some problems with maybe the way it resolved.
Right.
For me, the ending didn't feel completely earned and was a little bit disappointing because I had felt it was pretty engaging up until that point. But I really enjoyed the playwright's voice. I mean, for me, that was really the wonderful thing, is it was so millennial. It was so completely unfiltered, you know, no filter, very kind of graphic in terms of the way that the insults fly.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really true to life. And maybe even something kind of influenced by social media. I think previous generations had a sense of you know, diplomacy and things that you don't say, things that you self-censor. And I think that we have less and less of that in society. And I think he really caught that here. The way people really, they don't, whatever's on their mind is what comes out. You know, that's, you text it instantly. You don't filter it.
Right.
And I felt like all, pretty much, you know, that, I mean, the two main characters, Liam and Daphne, although they're very different, they share that. They say what they think.
Definitely. Definitely. Peter, do you feel like Harmon's voice is the main discovery here? It's also a great play.
Oh, I loved it. I had a great time. I thought it was entertaining. I thought that as Karen said, it just, once it started rolling, it never stopped. I thought I thought, though, I didn't think of it as much about social media and millennials as I did about Albee and how and how moving forward from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which I now think is the is sort of the play for, you know, for primal screams in American theater. And from that, from the moment at which George tells Honey, calls Honey monkey nipples, everything changed. Everything changed American theater. It allowed the floodgates to open, I think, for the kind of bile that gets spread in Bad Jews. And the interesting thing about Bad Jews is, to me, is it uses kind of Jewish intellectualism as opposed to alcohol as the fuel for people to talk, you know, in any way they want to each other. It's shocking, the play. My audience gasped
really
repeatedly at the cruelty that these two people threw at each other and at the other characters. And I am a sucker for cruelty on a stage expressed with this level of abandon. And so for all those reasons, I called it red meat theater marinated in fearlessness, because I thought Harmon was so brave. I mean, obviously in the context of a play, you know, brave, you know, it's not the same kind of courage people show in other fields, but
right.
But I thought it was fabulously expressive, and I, for that reason, I just loved it.
And Wendy, we come to you.
Yes, I did not love it.
Okay, yeah.
I think that some of that has to do with the production. On Facebook, I had a little discussion with another critic, Jason Zinneman, and he loved it, but what he said was really interesting. He said it should be directed as a fair fight, and I don't think the production that I saw was directed as a fair fight.
Okay.
I've seen video from the New York production, and the actress, Tracy Chimo, has like a lithium-fed kind of sluggishness to her responses that I think helps sort of, you know, foster a kind of sympathy for her. And the character in the production I saw, who played Daphne, was just relentless and obnoxious and unbearable, so that the scales were tipped so much more in Liam's favor.
Right.
And it worries me. I mean, it worries me that as this show travels, that, you know, that this sort of portrait of, you know, the monster, you know, the monstrous Jewish, overbearing Jewish woman will be spread far and wide. And it really worries me. I could see how it could work, you know, in the other way, and the balance could be more even. But in this production, it wasn't. And I have to say, you know, it's probably unfair, but I kind of can't help reading it as like a good for the Jews, bad for the Jews kind of thing. And I was reading another review, Michael Billington in The Guardian, this summer in August, reviewed it. And he said, he started the review with, in the current climate, the title of Joshua Harmon's 100-minute play takes on an extra level of provocation. And that really worried me, you know?
Yeah. Especially you're talking about Europe and England, you know?
During the whole conflict this summer in Israel, and to connect it to that, I don't know, that sort of portrayal and connection is, you know, just sort of a larger issue that I think, you know, can be problematic.
Wendy, I'm curious, do you think, I mean, is there an anti-female thrust for you?
I felt that there was an anti, well, I guess you could, I, you know what, in thinking of Melody, I would say yes, although.
Melody too, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds to me, Karen, that in the production you saw, Melody was sort of a benign figure, and I think sort of her personality turn that happens in the end, it can either be downplayed or played up, and it sounds like it was downplayed in the production you saw, which makes me think that it's really like an that it can be seen as like an anti-Jewish woman play, but you know, I could see it as misogynistic. Sure.
Well, I was going
to. You know, depends on the production, of course.
I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, for what it's worth, I think the Melody at the Magic had a certain integrity to her that kind of leavened the other aspect of the character. But both women are very much defined by their relationship to men. I mean, the sort of reveal that Daphne doesn't actually have a boyfriend and, and the weight of that, that she's imagined this male, for me, it was a little strain of disturbingness about it. That is ultimately what made her a little bit of a caricature. You know, that she, there's no man in her life, and it sort of kind of undercuts everything else she might stand for. I mean, she's crazy and abrasive and all these things, but that for me went a little too far.
I was going to say that I don't know which, and Melody, by the way, is the Shiksa girlfriend of Liam. The just so our listeners know, we didn't say all the names of the characters, I don't think, at any point. And I don't know which clips you saw, Wendy, but, you know, Tracy Chimo, some of her performance was subdued. Most of it was pretty on fire and fierce. And she was – I don't know, Peter, if you saw the New York production, but
– I didn't.
Yeah, it was – I think the issue of sympathy is interesting. I don't think either character comes out particularly well in this play, either Liam or her. But I will say, as a non-Jew, this did feel like a kind of play like – should I be laughing at this? Did it feel like it was airing? Did you feel like you're airing? It's airing the dirty laundry of arguments that, you know, that once exposed to the outside world, do they have this other resonance? You know.
You know that I wouldn't mind so much as this just sort of, you know, really vicious portrayal of a Jewish woman. You know, she was a monster in the production I saw. I don't know if it in every production, but there was one scene in which she was chasing them around a counter island. And I just thought, you know, my God, she's horrifying. You know?
Well, let me say, can I just say a couple of things? One being, this is a young playwright. There's no doubt about it. He doesn't quite master I think he knows how to hit the high notes. I'm not sure he knows how to hit the low notes, at least the sort of the ones that temper the drama a little bit. On the other hand, the production I saw made it very clear that Liam is just as much a monster as Daphne is. And that seems crucial to me because I had the same feeling. I got a little uncomfortable with the idea of her being sort of caricatured to the point where everyone would think, as Wendy said, you know, that you're getting that they're just, it's just dumping on Daphne, this play. And you can get that, but there's a very crucial scene early on when Liam arrives and you realize that, you know, his reactions to Daphne, and there's also a suggestion in this play of something sexual between them possibly, that's unresolved and not dealt with totally. It's more put on Daphne's shoulders than on Liam's. But Liam has a scene in the hallway where he basically humiliates his brother in the most obnoxious way that immediately, you know, turned me off to him as a figure of some sophistication. I mean, the fact that he's a University of Chicago grad student in Japanese culture seemed almost ironic to me, given his whole affect. But in this production, it was clear in his volcanic reactions to her that he was as much a problem in this family as she was in terms of how they dealt with each other. That was just my take. But I do understand the sensitivity and also it's interesting to hear Rob say that as a non-Jew, he became uncomfortable because I saw it probably with a mostly non-Jewish audience and I could sense their sense of like, how much am I allowed to laugh at these Jewish characters? While I was roaring, you know,
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that was finished.
Okay. I saw it with a mostly Jewish audience and I don't think that it succeeded very well. And again, I think that could be because of the direction, which it sounds like was an issue more from the production I saw than the ones you saw. But the audience that I was with was mostly older, mostly Jewish, and they did not seem thrilled. So that's just my take.
I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing that an audience is made put off or put on edge by a play.
Right.
I kind of, you know, this is not necessarily a bad thing, but still, I do think that there are issues for a young, very young playwright who's you know, writing a very raw piece and knowing how to, you know, how to bring this subject, how to corral some of these ideas, make them a little more palatable to a larger group of people.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like Daphna is just one of those great theatrical. She's a if she's a monster, she's like a fabulous monster. She's an original and great creation, like a Lady Bracknell or Mama Rose. You know, she's just huge. But I do see what you're saying, Wendy, about, you know, I can imagine it's been done in a lot of places all over the country and in many different contexts, it's safe to say. And with audiences, they're going to have a radically different composition. I think it's interesting, Peter, that it's not – Theater J is not the one doing this play, for instance.
I'm not surprised it's not Theater
J. Right,
of
course.
That's interesting. Yeah. Theater J, for people who don't know, is the theater in Washington based at the D.C. Jewish Community Center that does Jewish-themed work.
Yeah, this is not Fiddler on the Roof. This is not going to be done.
Which is also opening this week in Washington.
Yeah, at Arena Stage. Right. And Karen, I guess we're making an assumption here, Karen, that you're not Jewish by your last name. But
no, indeed not. And in fact, right. I was going to jump in with, I think it is pretty universal, though. I mean, these issues of cultural legacy, and my parents are from India. And, you know, I always had to traverse that delicate balance. Am I going to be an American? Am I going to honor the past? What does it mean if I don't honor the past? And I love the thing about the when Daphne is laying into Liam about how respectful he would be if he were in some Native American rain ceremony, how completely he would try to channel and inhabit that. And I think that's true. I mean, it's often much easier to be respectful of someone else's cultural heritage than your own, because in your own, you see all the flaws.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think it's interesting that it's a sign of some success that we're all, even you, Wendy, we're recalling bits of the play with relish and laughing, because, you know, it is a comedy.
I walked out of there. I didn't walk out of there really hating it. I walked out of there, you know, feeling that this was something that I really needed to think about for a good few days before I could form an opinion on it. And some of the writing is really fantastic.
I wonder, Wendy, you didn't write a review of this for the Philadelphia Inquirer, did you?
I didn't, no.
You didn't. I wonder, this is more of a sort of a question for all the critics. I know I've done criticism, and sometimes I don't know what I felt about a play until I write the review. Is that, as critics, do you feel like writing the review helps you sort out your feelings, and sometimes you surprise yourself when you're writing the review?
Absolutely. Yeah, sometimes when you realize what the nutcrack is, you realize everything else you thought about the show. Although, I mean, for me, the reviews we do them so quickly. We're cranking out sausage. That often it is, you know, a week later you think, oh,
yeah,
that's what I thought about that. But it's too late.
It's too late. Yeah. Peter, is that something that crosses your mind?
Yeah. Oh, sure. I'm sure. It's the wonderful luxury we have of going back and not only reacting to what we see, but then sitting down and really figuring out how to say what we thought, which automatically very often narrows and limits actually the experience of what you saw, because you can only have so many words to express it. And the frustrating thing often is not finding all those words that express all of what you felt about a play. And but this one I felt very visceral about. I didn't have that, I got to think about this one. I could feel the pleasure that I had in experiencing that I just, you know, I completely trusted, and that's what I go with. As you guys know, I mean, there are many plays where you don't have that clear a feeling, and that's when that's when you really do find out what you thought when you write the piece.
That's interesting. Yeah, so I was intrigued that Wendy, you this is your essentially your review of it, your comments today.
The critic from my paper she's also Jewish,
and Toby?
Toby Zinman, and she seems to really like it. But then I read other reviews from Philly, and it got a pretty mixed reaction. And again, I think that's a result of the production, more than the play.
Unfortunately, the production is something we can't reasonably compare amongst ourselves. We can we can say what we liked about the ones we saw. But the play itself, I think, under consideration. Is there anything else about it that you wanted to let any last licks you wanted to get in?
Well, I just would. I think we should just mention what Karen said at the very beginning about the ending of the play.
Sure.
Without giving it away too specifically, I do think that it is very manipulative, that ending, and again, it's still possible to love a piece of work that has given you this that makes you react so strongly, and yet still have problems with how it resolves. You can't ignore the fact that it's a problematic ending from both Karen and my perspective. I didn't, and maybe Rob.
Yeah, I agree.
But I do think that there's still, there's a lot of excitement to be considered in this playwright's future if he continues to write, and hopefully he'll find more work like this. The more ideas.
It's interesting, Peter, since you brought up the Albee Virginia Woolf model, I was just thinking about other plays that Disgraced is one on Broadway now. It's a bad dinner party that goes bad.
Yasmina Reza.
Yasmina Reza's stuff.
Right.
And, the ending is always tough. How do you end a play like that where everyone's had a rough time together and they walk away wounded?
Right.
All of them.
Right.
I also think, I think probably most critics had some trouble with the ending, but I would suspect maybe most audience members appreciate a little Lifetime TV moment at the end. A little bit of dessert just to make you feel better. So you walk away a little lighter than you might have, which is partially why it's a less provocative play. It's more interesting to walk away with an Albee feeling, with an unsettled feeling.
Well, Karen, Peter, Wendy, it's been a pleasure. I hope to get to do it again.
Thanks,
Rob. Delightful. Thanks for getting us together.
Yeah. Yes, fun.
All right, take care.
Thanks, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Welcome back. We did have some other thoughts about Bad Jews that I think you wanted to share, Susie. You love the show.
I do love the show, but I...
Tell me why you loved it.
We covered it a couple months ago.
We did. We had a great conversation with Alfred Urey and Joshua Harmon in the April issue.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I'm coming at for as someone who's not Jewish.
Right.
And so I know you had said that, Rob, it was hard laughing at it from the...
Yeah, from outside. I felt like, is it okay to laugh at this, but... I think I've learned that it's okay.
No, I sat in the front row when it was at Roundabout Underground in that little theater, and I was basically sitting in the living room with them. And part of why I loved it so much was Tracy Chimo's performance in New York. She was just astounding.
All I know is a hair.
But I
just see photos.
It's
photos of a giant head of hair.
I think what I liked about it is it was something that I could relate to as a young person. It was set in my neighborhood in an apartment. It was a living room play about people that I knew and could relate to, and it wasn't just stodgy Upper West Side rich people. It was these kids who were talking about issues of inheritance and wealth and class and religion. You think from the title it's just about religion, but there's a lot in there about class and sibling rivalry and family rivalry and judgment, and they're all conversations that I've heard in any context. And so, and the dialogue is just bitingly funny, but in a really honest way that really just kind of pokes you to your core, and you're like, oh
yeah, yeah.
Why, yes, someone has asked me how much I pay in rent. Yes, someone has questioned my apartment situation. Yes, someone has blah 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 blah. This is all very, this is too close to home, but it's great. It's fantastic.
Isn't asking about your rent just a New York thing?
It's not really. It's about a rent that in the play, there's they're living in this apartment. It's a studio apartment on the Upper West Side, and Daphna is coming to has come for the funeral. And she's very much your parents bought you this apartment. Not everyone's parents buy them spare apartments. And so.
Yeah. No,
I relate to her already.
It's,
I haven't seen
great.
It. I haven't seen it.
All the characters are flawed. There was a great line in the underground version that I think was cut by the time it went to the Pels. And was probably not in any of the regional productions, but Daphne comes in and she's, you know, talking her head off, and her cousin Jonah is on the video game and he's not paying attention to her. And she goes like, Jonah, are you like, stop playing video games. Like, pay attention to me. And he goes, I have to get to a point where I can pause. And it was like my favorite line in the whole play, because I have brothers and they're like, I can't talk to you until I like beat this level or get to a place where I can pause. I don't know. It was just like that sort of dialogue. And that like speaks to like, you don't see in theater a lot, or not in a lot of like major nonprofit theater.
I think
like
that line sounds familiar. We can check it in our published version to see if it's in there.
I don't think it is. I feel like I was talking to Josh at some party and I was, and like,
somehow
I think
got
it
cut.
Got cut. There was like one page that got cut between the Underground and the Pels. Anyway, it's a great play.
There was a part that I loved in the interview where he talked about how this woman sent him hate mail, Josh, because of the title.
The title, yeah. The title confuses people outside the world, but as Peter mentioned in our roundtable, I mean, bad Jews is something Jews say among themselves about someone who's, you know, not a good Jew, not following kosher, not going to the holy days.
Yeah. And bacon and, you know, dairy.
Yeah, having lots of bacon. Yeah, that kind of
thing.
My favorite part of the interview is when Alfred Uhry goes, when I was 30, I had 3 kids. And Josh Harmon goes, when you were 30, you had 3 kids? I don't even have a plant.
Yeah, that's generation gap right there.
See?
So I guess we can head to the last section of our show, which is endorsing things. Deep, why don't you take the lead? What do you think we should look at, think about, watch this week?
So on Veterans Day, I know this was a couple of weeks ago, but I didn't endorse in the last podcast. I'm going to do it now. On Veterans Day, I saw Bass Track, which is the new, which you wrote about, which is the new work from En Garde Arts. It's about Marines fighting in Iraq and then coming home. It incorporates interviews and photos of real-life Marines to talk about their experience inside this play about this man, his wife, and how they met when they were both really young, and then they get married, go off to Iraq. There's this part where she's giving birth, and she's wishing he was there, and her sister's like holding the phone close to her face so that he can talk to her during labor. And it's a play about real-life couple played by actors. But spoiler alert, they do divorce because of his PTSD issues, and he came back from Iraq. And it's kind of like, I remember Anne told me this during the chat I had with her, Anne Hamburger, who produced it. And she said that when it comes to military training, what they do is that they kind of dehumanize these people so that they can go off, go to war, kill other people, and be comfortable doing that and not be psychologically affected. And so they're able to survive in this really high intensity, stressful environment. And then they come back to like a normal life, and they don't know how to acclimate to that, because it's kind of like taking, yeah, it's trying to like tame something that's wild.
But you've sort of trained to be wild and then bring it back, and
back and then try and make it like, you know, put like a nice little sweater on it and tell it to be nice. I mean,
yeah,
that's not
sure,
going.
Sure.
It's, and then people, and you know,
but it was,
people
it's,
wonder
it's
why.
It's a good piece of theater.
It is a really good piece. Yeah, it's a really good piece of theater. The music is fantastic, and it's just this really moving. I mean, granted, it is another documentary theater piece about soldiers, but at the same time, it doesn't bang you over the head with, oh my god, this is so bad, this is so depressing. It's very, it's like, it's beautiful in like a very sad way, which is, you know, it's not, it's like, you won't feel bad after this. it's touring right now.
My endorsement is one that I think you might feel bad after, and I haven't seen it yet, but I'm sort of half really looking forward to it and half dreading it. It's a play called Rodney King. And it's a one-person show by Roger Grenfer Smith, who's a great solo performance artist. I saw him and loved his play, a Huey P. Newton story, which he did many years ago, like 20 years ago, in which he was Huey P. Newton on stage in this sort of like idealized, I've been hilarious and moving way. But he's done a number of docu-theater pieces over the years. In this one, he does not play Rodney King. He does do the entire speech by Rodney King that Rodney King gave during the riots, Can We All Get Along speech. But he basically plays a version of himself questioning Rodney King about his life and about his the things that led to, you know, both what happened to him the riots, and then to his unfortunate death at the age of 47. It's not uplifting material, but, you know, I was in L.A. at the time. It was a formative experience for me. And Roger's an artist I saw a lot of in L.A. at the time, and he actually lives in my old neighborhood. So it's a bit of a – he's bringing Rodney King back to New York. He was at the, under the radar last year. It's going to be at the Brick Arts Media, Brick House in Brooklyn. I haven't been to that new place yet. So I'm looking forward to that. It's sort of a weird homecoming of an artist and a topic very dear to me. So again, I'm not sure if it's going to be uplifting. It's got great reviews when it was here before, so I sort of can't wait to
watch
see it. Can't wait for it to be over. No. And Susie?
Well, my endorsement's something that's a little bit old, but I, over the Thanksgiving weekend, when I was not doing anything but sitting on my couch, I revisited or visited for the first time the Philharmonic's filming of Company. I'll make a little confession on the air. I'd never seen Company before. I'd seen...
What?
I know.
Stephen Sondheim's Company.
I'd never seen it. I knew most of the music, but I'd never actually seen it in its full form and with, you know, George Firth's book and everything. And I, you know, Company's a really good musical, you guys. You should watch it.
You go out on a limb and say that, huh?
But really? I don't know. The Philharmonic's, the filming of it, the one that Neil Patrick Harris and Patti LuPone and Christina Hendricks and Stephen Colbert and Martha Plimpton and Katie Finneran and Aaron Lazar and lots of cool people did. It's beautifully filmed and it's great production. I believe Lonnie Price directed it for stage and film. You can watch it on Amazon for like $3, and it's very, very worth your while if you haven't already. I mean, I know it's a few years old, so you all probably have, but if you haven't, you should.
Well, Patti LuPone saying Les Who Lunch is kind of the highlight of the evening.
I would say Katie Finneran singing I'm Not Getting Married Today or Martha Plimpton and Stephen Colbert doing karate on top of each other are pretty big highlights of it.
Yeah, you know, I have to say I've only seen bits of that. I haven't seen the whole thing, that particular concert. You know, there is no real movie version of that, so...
Not really. I mean, they filmed the John Doyle version.
Yeah, Raul Esparza and John Doyle version was filmed, too.
It was on Netflix for a while. It's now on Amazon Prime, but...
That, I will say, I was one person who liked that more than other people, but that's not...
I quite enjoyed that one, actually.
It's not an ideal introduction to the piece, I don't think.
Well, that was my introduction to the piece, and I loved it.
Actually, I saw tiny chamber productions of it in L.A., and I love those. Those were with just like a piano and people. And you know, Sondheim works really well in an intimate space.
This would be great in an intimate space.
Yeah,
especially Company because it's very much like it's a domestic.
Yeah, well, no, it's
dramedy.
It's a great musical. Stephen Sondheim knows what he's doing.
It is great.
Yeah, he's going to go places one day.
It's a little promising kid, that guy. On that fine note, although I hear he's a bad Jew. No, just kidding.
No.
No, he's not.
I bet he gets paid for what he does.
Who are we to judge? So in any case, I think that wraps up another fine off-script episode. Go online to americantheater.org to see links to the things we talked about, and check us out in iTunes. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. Thanks for listening.